Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with us as always is Steve. How are you doing?
Hey John, hey Sean, how are you guys?
Yes, and Sean is we're lucky to have with us this week as well. Perfect for some insights on blockchain, crypto, DeFi, and general knowledge, I think.
Yeah, thanks, Steve and John. Really excited to be here and excited for this conversation.
You should be excited because we have Luca Cosentino, the product lead at Oasis Foundation, with us this week. How are you doing, Luca?
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me.
Definitely, you're definitely in an exciting area, a confluence of a lot of things going on: privacy, the consumer advocacy, the politics of controlling data is kind of an emerging thing, actually emerging and fighting over for the past few years now. Tell us about your background a little bit and what you guys are doing over at the Oasis Foundation.
Sure thing. Yeah, I come from a background in large corporates. I work for Procter & Gamble, American Express, Google, PayPal. And in each of these companies, I've always covered roles that were in between product, go-to-market, and data. So I always had this responsibility of looking at the data, figuring out what was going on, spotting new opportunities, and then using the same data to inform like product decisions, and then coordinating most of the aspects of building products and taking products to the market. So I've always developed this skill set of really understanding the problem first and then like focusing on the solution. After my experience at Google, I moved to the Bay Area where I started an MBA at UC Berkeley. I wanted to be in Silicon Valley and I wanted to be exposed to the most innovative place for tech. And
Oh, where
when
were
I
you
was,
before Silicon Valley?
I so I'm Italian, so I was in Rome at the beginning of my career, which is where I grew up as well. But then I moved to London. I had a couple of other experience across Europe, but yeah, the city where I lived the most time after Rome is London. And then I moved to the Bay Area.
Oh, okay, so you were at Google in Europe then?
Yeah, I was at Google in London, yes.
Ah, okay. So you weren't responsible for them taking out the "Don't be evil" part of their
No,
mission.
I was involved in the. You remember there was another problem that Google had to face back in time, which was this thing
So
that.
many, so many.
There were so many. Yeah, one in particular was related to ads on YouTube that were passing over or like giving money to like some bad organizations, and so that was like a big project to sort of restore the reputation and also to change the algorithms and change the way some of the monetization policies worked.
Interesting. So you spent time, as you mentioned, in Google, which has had a lot of privacy issues, but you're working with Oasis here, which has a really interesting privacy-focused blockchain product. Can you walk us through that and also what the impetus for focusing on privacy and enabling user control of your data, how that's affected the way in which you've built your product?
Yeah, absolutely. So the background story here is that exactly because I observed how these companies deal with data and all the security measures that they try to apply in order to protect data breaches or other unintended actions from either employees or malicious actors, I sort of came across this problem that I wanted to solve when I was in business school. And I said, it doesn't make sense to me that companies spend so much money and so much effort to protect the data, but then me myself, like entering a company as an employee, essentially I can have access to a crazy high amount of data at any point in time. And the only thing I need to do is really like figuring out the table. Maybe you can argue that the name of the table is not always well, it's not always clear, but definitely with a little bit of effort, you figure that out. You issue an access request to someone who's based in some other geography. that doesn't really know anything about who you are or why you need the data for. And only the only thing that he or she knows is really the explanation that you put, which is generally, I really need the data because my boss wants me to run this, analysis. It's kind of, I think 99% of the time they get this answer. And yeah, like, and then all of a sudden they grant you access, right? So end of the day, you lost a week, but you have access to your tables. And then what happens? Then like it's really up to you, up to me, up to the employee to protect the information. And so that made me think about like, this is weird. It doesn't make sense. There must be a better way to do it. And if there's a better way to do it internally, there must be a better way to do it externally, meaning why companies cannot cooperate on the data without sacrificing the privacy of the user, but why can they not really collaborate on data sets in a way that the user can benefit from and in a way that is very transparent to the user, and the user has the possibility to say yes or no. So I imagine this concept of this like black box that would enable companies to share data either internally or externally. And when the data is put inside this, into this black box, the black box can be programmed to execute some computation on this data, but it's not allowed to release any information, right? And when I was like developing this idea, I had a couple of use cases in mind. Maybe one that I had in mind was this case of, I don't know, like American Express sharing data with Amazon when a user links the bank account, links the credit card. And in that specific moment, this black box is created. American Express can put the data inside this black box. Amazon can use the data to query and build some like machine learning models that are used to offer me, the user, more personalization of the content that I see on Amazon, right? Based on my 10 years of history with American Express. This doesn't really happen because American Express signed a contract with the users and say like, we're not gonna share your data with anyone, at least in individual form. And B, like it's very complicated to put two companies at the same table to make something happen. And everything must be resolved with like legal contracts. And I said, okay, maybe there's a way to do it with blockchain. So by the time I was studying more about blockchain, I thought of like asking help, asking for some help. I Googled privacy preserving experts and Professor Dong Song's name came up. She's the founder of Oasis Labs, which is the company that I ended up joining. At the time, it was not even a company, but it was a research project at UC Berkeley that I joined. We ended up raising $45 million from like primary investors, and we built this team. So that's the background story, which I think is interesting to define, like to set a little bit of context. In terms of what we do, this is really what it was. Like if we do this black box, and I'm going to explain in a second why this analogy is not really correct, but it conveys the message. So we create this black box where parties can put the data and can program the data to be revealed or not. And even when it's not, there is still the ability to compute on this data and to only release some output of a certain computation. So one example here, which again is not entirely correct, and I'll explain why, but it conveys the message, is if you wanna, I don't know, like say, if the four of us want to share our, I don't know, how much money we have in the bank account, we really have like two ways. Either we tell each other the data, or we hire a third party that is gonna keep the data, is going to hold it and is going to analyze it and is going to give us the answers that we want. Both cases are problematic because in both cases, we'll have to trust someone. And by now, we know that this is not really applicable because of the incentives that these situations create. In the first case, you have an incentive to not only lie, but also do something with the data you acquire. And in the second case, that company, you need to trust them that not only today, tomorrow, or for the next 3 years, they're gonna behave like according to the legal terms, but also 20 years from now, and we know how complicated it is to like hide the information and make sure that people obey to the contract when they don't have an obligation anymore, or for things that are very hard to verify.
First off, fascinating product. Curious to hear more about how do you and your product clearly differentiate yourself from the other third-party companies that follow, you know, the sort of the, you know, SOC 1 and SOC 2 regulations. And can you explain to the wider crowd what is it specifically about blockchain that makes your product much more secure than those other two options that you mentioned?
Yeah, absolutely. So the I want to give you an answer in two parts here. The first one is why we are different from other companies, and the second one is why blockchain. They are related, but they also lead to separate motivations. The first part is why we're different from other companies, and the answer that I want to give you here is that a lot of companies focus on the compliance aspect and on specific regulation. So they try to build a product that essentially adds a little bit of intelligence to like simply storing data and using data inside a company. And what they do is that they look at the data, they put this data in the context of some regulation, and they say yes or no to whatever the data can be exposed or not because of compliance reasons, right? Or whatever the data, or whether the data can be stored or not, like stuff like that, right? Like they obey to some rules. The problem with that approach is that if the rule says no, there's really like nothing you can do in that context. So the best way to see that is almost like an on and off type of approach. And when it's off, it's actually off, right? What we do is a little bit different from that because we try to deal a little less with like regulation and we don't necessarily want to become the experts of specific regulations, but what we're trying to do is allowing companies to offer better privacy guarantees to their users because they offer the mathematical guarantee that the data of the user A stays with the user and B, even when the user decides to allow the company to actually use this data for some objective, the data stays private and is not revealed to the company. And this essentially enables this new form of collaboration between user and companies, where even when the user shared the data, the company doesn't have access to the data, which creates a completely different situation in terms of who has the power of saying yes or no, because the company doesn't see the data, they cannot acquire the data, and so they cannot cooperate with the user at time one and then screw the user over at time two, because they will still need to have a very good relationship with the user in order to access the data that that belongs to the user. And I've got to give you an example as well. But before doing that, I wanted to give you the second part of the answer, which is why blockchain. And the answer here is very straightforward, and you're probably going to like it because it's a great application of blockchain. So the problem with the black box that I described before is that who has access to the black box, right? If you want to do this in a trustless way, you cannot rely on one company, say Oasis, to be the gatekeeper or to be the holder or the owner of this black box. If it's the company, the user has no way to trust or to verify what the companies will do with the data. And if it's the user, you will require the user to take a significant amount of effort to actually store that black box somewhere. So blockchain really helps there. You have a network of independent nodes that independently verify that a certain calculation is okay, that people are not trying to take advantage, that there are no malicious actors. And we created a system which is called like the consensus in the blockchain space that allows these users of this platform, whether they're companies or users, not to trust anyone or not having to trust anyone, because the only thing they trust is the decentralization level.
That's great. A fascinating example too. So just kind of walking through with that example, because I think that's a really interesting use case. So let's say, you know, John wants to get a genetic, you know, gene test, you know, really highly valued genes. Like he doesn't want anyone to hack his genetic code to the public, you know. So he would use your platform. What's this mathematical guarantee that he would get that his information wouldn't be leaked, that we wouldn't see small, like, you know, mini Johns running around everywhere?
Yeah, the mathematical guarantee is offered by the consensus layer that I was referenced to before. So the thing is, in blockchain, this consensus layer, it's a system of independent verifiers. We have over 80 in this case, that independently get to an understanding, like get to verify a certain piece of information. And this verification is not really on the information, but it's on the actual proof that the computation runs in like the way it's intended to run and it's not compromised.
So it's like a stamp kind of? It's like a stamp saying, hey, look, you know, this is actually a black box. Here's a mathematical guarantee that no one else has access to it. It's in this black box that we can't even see. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's actually a good analogy, I'd say. It's a good analogy because these people will independently stamp this like the authenticity of what's happening and the correctness of what's happening, and they do it in an independent way. And then the consensus mechanism based on blockchain makes it essentially very, very expensive, if not prohibitively expensive, to compromise these nodes, because you need to go one by one to these nodes and make them agree to jeopardize your like the project that they are verifying. And in order to do so, you need to offer more incentives than what the platform already offers them, right? And it turns out that there are a lot of like game theory mechanisms there that prevents a subset of nodes to do it, because it's not just a matter that like, oh, you try to be malicious and see what happens. These systems are built in a way that penalize node operators that try to jeopardize or compromise the network. So back to the point before, it's not that it's technically impossible, but it's financially extremely inconvenient to do it.
Mm-hmm. So if someone wanted to basically hack John's genetic information in this kind of example, they would really just not be able to do it from a financial perspective, because there's no single point of failure. They don't have to just hack one system. They have to hack the blockchain and kind of piece all those together because they're distributed. Is that kind of what?
That's right.
Okay.
You mentioned a few things that sort of would attract the consumer. It's, of course, it's more secure. Your data is more secure. It may be financially cheaper as well to do it. Which ones of those two do you think will get you the biggest traction? Are people more concerned about with saving money and making transactions faster and cheaper, or with securing their data?
And you think those two are like trade-off or like mutually exclusive, or you think there's a way to achieve both?
Ideally both, but I find that in some cases you do kind of have to trade both. And I think that as a society, we've made these trade-offs, right? We use free services like Google and Facebook, but I'm wondering whether what you are working on here will bring on this new era of actually we can have both.
So your question is basically whether people jump into privacy-preserving products, especially when the convenience of centralized product is already there, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, well, this is a very, in my opinion, is first of all, is one of my favorite questions, but it's also a very long one. So after having thought about this like multiple times, I think the answer that I got to can be maybe split into a couple of bullet points, let's say. The first one is, there is an historical trend that started probably like 3,000 years ago that shows that every time there is a new product, people jump on the product no matter what the cost is, right? And privacy, it's always sacrificed in favor of the ability to access this new product. This goes back to 3,000 years ago when, I don't even know if there were houses at that time, but it's the moment in time when like people were having sex outdoor because they didn't have walls in their houses. And then when walls were invented and spread, people moved inside. And then like flash forward to many years later, you have the example of the telephone, which was this big machine in big rooms where essentially like everyone who wanted to use it had to listen to what everyone else was saying, but also to be listened by everyone else. And then someone invented the headphones as a need to protect from unintended, like from other people in the room, right? And now you're having a similar case with all these messaging platforms that are for sure, like the WhatsApp built crazy adoption without privacy, even if it's not entirely true, because they built this end-to-end encryption for quite some time. And now you're seeing like other platforms such as like Telegram, but also like Signal, which is the most recent use case or more recent product. So it's hard to draw a line between like to what extent people are interested versus to what extent people are not interested. The second thing that that I want to say is that, yeah, it's very true that there is an impression that people don't really care about privacy, especially from the point of view of people who build products. But I found myself in that position, justifying building like product inside my company. And a lot of the time I was looking for data, right? And I came across this very interesting sort of loop where product builders observe the market and conclude that people don't care about privacy. And as a consequence of that, they build products without privacy. Or if not without privacy, at least like making privacy extremely hard to maintain. Like if you get a massive pop-up that covers the text that you're reading, you click the button that removes the product, that removes the pop-up. You're not gonna read it. So I wouldn't take that as a sign that you don't care about privacy. I take it as a sign that you're really not offered the way to care about privacy. Mm. And because product builders don't observe customers like caring about products, they end up building products without the ability to keep their privacy separate or like their data private, right? And so it's kind of a reinforcing loop where you have people who build product observe customers, and so they don't care about privacy, so they don't build privacy into product. But because customers are not given any chance to do it, they end up not caring about it. And to me, the way this boils down is, it's not a matter of caring about privacy or not, but it's almost like the wrong way to look at this phenomena. But it's mostly, what are the incentives for the user to care about privacy? And that's why a company like Nebula Genomics that I mentioned before is a great example, because they didn't approach the market only saying, oh, you know, it's fair that you own your data, but they create an entire new set of incentives for the company or to collaborate with the users and for the users to care about the data. To me, that's 10 times more fascinating than whether people care or not about privacy.
Interesting. That makes sense. And just so we noted here, you mentioned the Signal process, and that's that Signal just announced that they're doing cryptocurrency-based transactions and payments, right?
Yeah, exactly. I came across the news, but I didn't read a lot. But what I think is that there is this new trend now that platforms are increasingly populated with user-generated content, right? Maybe messaging platforms are the easiest example, but you can think of creators economy like Clubhouse. You can think of sharing economy like Airbnb. You can think of ton of other examples these days. And one of the things that is becoming very evident is that people care about what they produce, right? What they own. And when they do, they care a lot about them. The problem is that if they don't own the underlying platform somehow, it's going to be complicated to justify having this like layers above where the user get paid and can expose to things. But then you will always have this imbalance between the value that the user produced for the platform, right? Compared to the actual control that they have of the, on the platform. And so I think the direction of enabling tokens or cryptos or forms of value exchange inside these huge distribution channels is indeed the very first step to A, reward creators for their creations, and B, give more and more ownership, more and more voice to the people who contribute to the success of a product.
And how can users get involved on the Oasis platform? I know that you guys have some sort of ambassador program. where you can amplify your signal. But is there any way to get involved in this financially? Can you buy a token for this?
Yeah, so our the Oasis network is up and running. It has been running since November in its mainnet, and it's fully decentralized, which means that we don't have any control anymore on the network. And the token is live. The reason why the token is very important is because it powers the consensus layer. So the node operators that I described before are the ones that get compensated in ROSE tokens. Actually, they first stake tokens and then they receive tokens as rewards. And so they are the ones who need ROSE, right? So all the security model of this blockchain platform runs on the ROSE token.
When I was looking at Ethereum years ago now, I was thinking by now this would be kind of more mainstream, more implemented. You know, what kind of time frame should we be thinking about where this becomes closer to the default for a lot of places?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the context of blockchain, I think I'm actually really impressed by the progress that the industry made. I think I can remember maybe like three phases of blockchain. The first one was the 2016-17 with all the crazy fundraising processes and the impossibility of understanding who would do what and who would actually deliver what. The second phase was, okay, now we have the money as a market, how we go about it. And that generated a competition for attracting the next like news article or the next like high level partnership or the next like PR announcement to essentially pump the token price up and profit from a bull market. Then like this crypto winter started, so that logic didn't apply anymore. And I think that was the moment when maybe 80%, 90% of the industry realized that there was a change and it was the time to start moving forward with the real use cases. Otherwise, we are very happy because like our token only went live recently, so we didn't participate in the first two moments, and we're very proud of that. So we could only focus on the attracting real adoption. Now this year, I think you have seen like a ton of usage. You are seeing, okay, from Tesla, that of course like has a visionary founder, so you can argue that there's a lot of reasons why they're doing that. But then you see other use cases such as like Visa, who is building a full crypto team, PayPal, who's doing the same. And those are like very real use cases that go even beyond just buying and selling Bitcoin, which could be seen as not as real adoption, not as a sign of adoption, but maybe as a sign of like store of value or speculation or whatever you want to call it. So I'm actually pretty excited about the development and the industry showed. It's also very clear that by now there is a performance problem, right? So Ethereum is innovating, is trying to innovate. I mean, maybe slowly than what they could, but they're trying to make the network faster. But at the same time, other chains, Oasis is one of those, are coming to the market, being very credible, being higher in performance and so on. And then there is, I'd say, the second way to look at this, which is something we believe a lot into at Oasis, which is blockchain should not be applicable only to decentralized developers or like developers of decentralized applications, but it should be really applicable and really interesting for enterprises who simply want like a simple product or a simple API to benefit from the properties of blockchain. And so that segment, I think, has done a ton, right? Just ourselves, like we announced a few partnerships and a few proof of concepts with primary brands, like BMW is one of those. They are very interested, and the use cases that they cover tend to be all around data management, data privacy, but at the same time, they are different in the nature and in the threat model that they need to face. Nebula, the example that I gave before, it's live on the website. You can go and register, so that works. So I'm frankly...
It's happening now, basically. It's all getting live, built and hitting out,
Yeah, it's live. So you can go on the website and either register with the normal flow or register with the privacy preserving flow.
So it looks like you have plenty on your hands going forward. So thanks for so much for joining us on the podcast, and keep up the good work.
Happy to share what we do, yeah.
And we'll have to have you back before your IPO.
You know, like the...
Your blockchain, ICO. Direct listing, core token offering.
Yeah, we are mixing a lot of these. I'm just joking. No, I think our it's going to be interesting to see where decentralized networks are going to go with that, right? We'll see. But yeah, we're very excited about this new direction that the company's taking around, like, the ownership in general, which has a ton of application in fintech, because, you know, when we label all these aspects as like data privacy, people immediately default to regulation, compliance, and all these aspects. But here, the way we're interpreting this whole effort is really from the point of view of enabling new use cases that were not possible and that are not possible because the data is in the hands of like very few central parties. And when you start thinking of the problem of data as an incentive problem rather than a compliance problem, you end up in a world where you have a ton of possibilities that were not even clear just a few years ago.
Yeah, right. That's so true with every new technology. People never were able to predict how it got applied and used and filtered through, you know, every part of society and business. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I should be thinking about it more like that. Best of luck to you. That's Luca Cosentino, the product lead at Oasis Foundation. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news, and thank you for listening.